Safety Subcommittee. I'm going to ask that we stand at ease for about 3 minutes while hopefully members who are looking at their television sets can scurry on down.
Perfect.
Boy, she ran quick.
We have four items on our agenda this afternoon, starting with an informational and procedural overview, followed by a program area overview, and then a discussion of the chair's expectations and goals. And then we will have I anticipate a very rich conversation with several leaders in the administration of justice arena. And with that said, Doug Wilson from Legislative Fiscal Office, would you help us get started?
Sure. Madam Chair, I will quickly go. First, I just want to outline or introduce the staff. Diane Myers, who's sitting behind you, is our committee clerk and probably the most important staff member. And I'm the scheduler for this subcommittee, which means basically I'll work with the chair in setting the schedule. And if you have any questions that you can't direct to a specific analyst on public safety, please give me a call. And when we get a little further into this, you'll see I have a list of telephone numbers and such. I don't plan to spend a lot of time on this because all of you sat in subcommittees this morning doing the same thing. So I'll quickly go through this. This is a 1 o'clock starting time, and the chair, as indicated a few seconds ago, is pretty strict in starting that, so keep that in mind. As session goes on, that will become a challenge as the floor sessions can go on beyond noon and sometimes even beyond 1. So we will work with your folks when that starts happening and work with the chair on setting times and letting people know what if a meeting has to be delayed. In terms of the rules, they're attached in this packet, which in front of you is an agenda. And the agenda will look like this every day. You'll see one of these generally on every day. What I try to do at the bottom of each of these agendas in the italicized print will give you sort of an idea of what's happening in the near future. So, and then you'll also get a weekly schedule either delivered to your office or given to you in here toward the end of the previous of the week for that, and then we'll give it out for next week. Terms of rules are already adopted when the full committee adopted them. The only one I want to outline is the importance of a quorum in this committee. Since there are 6 members, 3 from each side, a quorum is 2 people on each side of the table in terms of the Senate and the House, and the same is for voting. So attendance, not to go back to our school days, is important just for the lack of for getting information or a lack of quorum. Coffee is to be provided. I don't know, do we have coffee today? What? It starts next week, I understand. And as you probably were told this morning, these microphones can be very sensitive. I think the microphones in mic F are even more sensitive. But these, if you're in hot side conversations, make sure you either cover it or you may show up. And that also stands for sometimes at the end of a meeting, Diane may not reach over quick enough and turn it off, so those side conversations can be picked up at the end of the meeting. It's just a reminder to be careful. I mentioned already in the agenda, I'm working off the memo here, which I think all of you have in front of you. The agenda, I already outlined that, and a weekly agenda will be available. There's a list of all the budget bills back in your packet, a couple pages that look like this. These are the bills that have been assigned to the committee already. These are all the agency bills and a couple cases fee bills. On that list is the bill number of the agency, the LFO analyst. You'll notice here that we have 4 or 5 analysts, myself, John Borden, who will be doing a couple of the smaller agencies, Robin Lamont, who does the judicial branch agencies, as well as Susie Jordan, who does the military department. Both Susie and Robin are in trade and economic development this afternoon doing their overview. They're not here. And so as they come in, we'll make sure you're introduced to them if you have not all been already. Our phone numbers, as well as a DAS analyst who may be here today or may not. I'm not sure. I'll make sure I introduce them. Linda Gilbert, if you could stand, Linda. Sorry, Linda. But she does a number of the public agencies, safety agencies. She's sort of the lead analyst in public safety from the DAS side. And Bill McGee is here, who does, I know, DPSST. Is that it? CFA, if CFA is still here. And we'll discuss at a later date. And there's some others listed here, and I'm not sure if anyone else is here from BAM. Getting the indication they're not. So that's another resource for you. But if you have general questions about agencies, contact the analyst assigned to that agency. Or if you're not sure who to talk to or it's a larger issue, feel free to give me a call or stop into our office down the hall. The next page on the memo sort of outlines the order of agencies. I think we'll go into phase one and phase two a little bit more when the chair discusses things, but you'll notice on the second page of that memo the order of agencies that we plan, at least at this stage, to move forward. The phase one agencies are the larger agencies, and the order we plan to take will be Justice, Corrections, Judicial, Public Defense Services Commission, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, State Police, and the Youth Authority. The other agencies that are not included in Phase 1 are listed there. They're generally smaller agencies, or in some cases those that don't have a lot of general fund, like the military department, which is also a significantly sized agency, but its general fund component is not that large. These were selected by the co-chairs a week or two ago, and we'll see how we move through the process. But in terms of phase one, the schedule is set. It still may move around a bit, but those are the agencies. Down in the middle on the second bullet on that page, other matters to be handled by the subcommittee. We'll likely see some program bills or some program legislation in here that have a fiscal impact, most likely from the Judiciary Committee at times. Federal grant applications may come in here, probably not to the same degree as something like the Human Services Subcommittee, but you may see some of those at some point in time where the legislature or the emergency board, when the legislature is not in session, must approve the authority to an agency to apply for a federal grant. There are fee bills that will come through here. Two have already been assigned. State Fire Marshal and the Board of Investigators. I know we'll probably have to discuss fees around the State Police on one of their issues when we get to their budget. And there may be the potential for rebalances, which is not as significant as Department of Human Services rebalances, and you've probably heard the term reshoot this morning. If you were in that subcommittee, I'm sure Senator Winters knows all about those. But there may be, depending as you get close to close the fiscal year, corrections and state police may have to. They have not indicated any way to that point. But sometimes you do have to move some things around, make sure the things are in the right appropriation lines. One item that the governor has in his budget that if we follow the governor's budget will have to be acted on early will be a capital construction bill for the Department of Corrections. That's part of their assumed in the governor's budget. That will have to be acted on and discussed early on, probably starting a week or so away from now, or a week and a half away from now, dealing with whether they go ahead with their planned construction. And we'll spend some time, not next week, but the week after, with the Department of Corrections going through forecasts, their prison management plans, construction plans, and give you as much background as we can with that. At the same time, I think we'll try to give some background early on sentencing
and what's driving those. And we'll have, I think we'll probably ask Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission to come in and give a short presentation on sentencing guidelines and things like that in that time, so you know what's sort of pushing the prison population. The budget hearing process, you've heard this before. You will probably get, by the end of the day, the first presentation materials for the Department of Justice, which starts on Monday. You'll get it attached, a notebook or whatever, attached to a memo like this. That should also include the presentation materials, budget priority forms, 10% cut lists, as well as the analysis, the LFO analysis of the governor's recommended budget for that agency, which we'll give you a copy for that agency, but I think you were all delivered a full copy of that multi-100-page document earlier in session. Please keep in mind, bring your copy of the notebook that's delivered to you for the agency presentation. We don't have extra copies, and so when we deliver it, please bring it to here the first day. You can leave it in here or take it back, but you need to have it here for the meetings. Moving on to the third page of this memo, real briefly, the work session process for the new members is generally led by our staff based on discussions with the co-chairs, our analysis of the budget, discussions with the subcommittee chair, and then we'll make recommendations based on those things, and then you, of course, will act on it. Right now, work sessions will be weeks from now, most likely. The phase two budgets, there are some small ones in there that could be taken up in probably mid-March, but I would not expect to see any work sessions until after mid-March in this subcommittee. I know in full committee there was discussion about budget notes. Keep in mind there will be people, maybe some even in this audience, that may bring ideas for budget notes to you. Keep in mind, budget notes do not have the rule of law. They are things that go into something called the budget report. They must be approved by the co-chairs before they're brought to the subcommittee, and I would strongly urge you to share them with the subcommittee chair, too, because she is a very important person.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. I just from a process and procedural standpoint, I would more than strongly recommend that you have your subcommittee chair review those, and that becomes the conduit then for the subcommittee chair to then discuss it with the co-chairs. Thank you.
And we will proceed in that manner, committee members.
Keeps communication open and flowing.
Yes, it does.
Under other subcommittee-related items, the chair has suggested and expressed interest in visiting facilities. I think next Tuesday, we will likely hold a hearing at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville. The meeting will be held at, will start again at 1 o'clock. And we'll have a public hearing in terms of the presentation by the Department of Corrections as part of the normal presentation. And then after that, a tour will be available for that facility. That is the women's prison as well as the intake center. And is their newest large prison, which Madras, the next big prison that is being constructed, while it's not based on that design, it follows as they sort of go through the evolutionary process of what the next set of prisons will look like. The subcommittee chair has also expressed an interest in maybe touring the state penitentiary as well as one of the jails, probably Marion County Jail, because of its proximity. We may very well schedule that sometime during phase one as the schedule plays out. And if you want to visit any other facilities, whether they're OIA, corrections, please visit with me or the analyst in that, and we'll help you set that up at the agency, give you suggestions if you wish. Or as a committee, we can set things up, but we'll need to be careful out in terms of the tightness of the schedule. One other item that the chair has expressed interest is maybe holding a hearing at the Homeland Security offices, what we call C4 building, which is out past the penitentiary and State Street. And we may very well, when we get to the State Police Homeland Security time, schedule something out there, which is very close, as one of the hearings of the subcommittee. The last thing in terms of the orientation or procedures, at your desk is, you probably saw this morning, the performance measure links to Oregon benchmarks, the Oregon Progress Board put that together. And I think in both the subcommittees that you have were sitting in this morning, they briefly went over this, so I won't go through it, but it is a handy document to sort of link what benchmarks are tied to the agencies, the public safety agencies, and it's a good resource document for you. Again, either leave it here, or if you want to use it during subcommittee, you need to bring it with you, because this is the copy that's available. Representative Hannah.
Madam Chair, I don't know if we've had time to answer the question yet. The page referencing to that, has that been resolved?
Someone mentioned that to me real late this morning, and I haven't had time to check up on that. So I will, someone will get back.
Somebody's going to have to figure it out, because we can't.
Well, actually, the person in our office who knows the most about this, Paul Siebert, happens to be out sick today, so it may take a day or two to get back to you on
that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think that pretty much settles or takes care of what I wanted to talk about in this part of the agenda, other than to say that the rules, as well as the presentation guidelines and a memo from the co-chairs around the presentation guidelines, are also attached to this memo.
Mr. Wilson, thank you. Are there any questions or comments that will help your understanding? I want to say what a pleasure it's already been to work with Doug Wilson. In fact, we're starting to think alike. We both came into this meeting this afternoon with sentencing guidelines grid, both having the same thought that we want to make sure that our committee has an orientation around this subject. But again, Doug, thank you so much for your preparation for this meeting. Do you want to move now into the program overview area?
There's a document that looks like this in front of you with a cover. I'm going to quickly go through this. I don't think we'll go into the detail. At least some of the subcommittees this morning went into orientation because you just sat through 3 days of it in the public safety overview. I do want to go through just a couple graphs and things to give you a little background in some reference documents. So if you turn to the first page, I wanted to give you an idea of sort of the look of public safety before ballot measure 11 and after, and that's sort of the theme that goes through here. So if you take a look at the first page and there's two pie charts there, 93-95 is the biennium before ballot measure 11, or represents a biennium. You'll notice that public safety represented 13% of the general lottery funds. And in the governor's recommended budget for 05-07, it represents 17%. The definition I'm using for public safety here is judicial branch and the public safety agencies. And that's different than you may have heard, for example, yesterday in full committee. But for us, in terms of LFO, we think of them as being together, judicial branch and public safety. And so the numbers you'll see, and when we discuss public safety, will include that, both of those. There are differences in how they're structured and things, in the sense that the judicial branch is a separate branch of government, is treated differently. But I think because of the interrelatedness that you heard over the past 3 days, they need to be thought of together because they are dependent on each other. So this just shows you what's happened in terms of through a period of biennia. If you want to sort of the background, public safety during these two biennia in terms of the general fund and lottery funds went up by 126% in terms of expenditures compared to total state government spending of 77%. So it has been increasing significantly. The next page is just a quick bar graph of what's in the governor's budget for both general fund and all other funding sources. As you can see, Department of Corrections is by far the largest. It represents roughly 54% of the general fund and lottery funds, and you can see the relative size of the other agencies. The lighter gray is other and federal funds. And based on a question Representative Hannah had yesterday, I attached the next page or put together sort of what the major other and federal funding sources for public safety agencies are. Not all the agencies are here, but these are the major ones, and I'm not going to go through it. It's here for your reference. But there are significant funds in some of the agencies dealing with capital construction in terms of COP. Proceeds, federal revenues and child support, and in the military department, and in Homeland Security funds in the Office of Homeland Security.
Doug, before you go further, Representative Hannah, please take a close look at the page, and feel free to ask any questions or to comment on anything that you see there, which is here at your request.
I appreciate having the information, and I'll review it closely.
All right.
Yep.
Regardless of the importance of other and federal funds, this is generally a general fund area, unlike human services, which depend in large part on general fund, but matches great amounts of federal funds. This is primarily a general fund area. The next page in this short packet, again, is sort of a dual pie chart. And this shows the breakdown within the public safety area of agencies, the major agencies, between a pre-ballot Measure 11 and a post and the governor's budget for 0507. And again, you'll notice that corrections has grown significantly from 41% of the general fund and lottery funds in 93-95 to representing 54% in 0507. Those that lose funding, or their proportional share of funding in general fund and lottery funds, are judicial branch, going from 30% to 21%. Oregon Youth Authority actually goes up because they are, you know, a lot more. Between those periods, you build a lot more facilities out there. We can get into that. And the state police and Homeland Security fell dramatically from 15% to 9% of the pie. All other agencies actually grew a little bit during that period, and Department of Justice basically stayed the same. Another question.
Senator Devlin.
Well, thank you, Senator Gordley. I believe that Representative Wisnett was before me. If that's okay, he was. Oh, okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Senator Gordley, Wilson. I think one of the things important, obviously, is to keep in mind, even though the percentages have changed, the absolute dollar amounts are obviously quite higher in 2005-2007. And I think if you went to 93-95, although there was already significant certificates of participation for the Department of Corrections, by this time there's much more significant debt service for the Department of Corrections, and actually obviously new debt service for BPSST. And some of these areas would not really have any particular increase, although the Oregon Youth Authority did have some increase during that period also.
Right. On the next page, just to show you sort of what's driving some of this, or the results and consequences of sort of the change in the proportional shares, this is a graph that shows sort of the impact of the growth in prison population starting back in 1989 and going through 2014, which the current forecast goes through. You'll see that ballot measure 11 has a large impact, but also even more recent changes in terms of the repeat property offenders has also had a growing effect on the prison population. So that just gives some more background. And one of the consequences of the state police losing their share is the next graph, which is the number of sworn troopers for the patrol division, which back in the early 80s, late 70s, was over 600. When they transferred off the highway fund, that was sort of the first reduction. But it has fallen significantly to what is essentially 325 sworn positions these really represent troopers on the road in the patrol division in the governor's budget.
Senator, question. Senator Dillon brought up a good point, and it may be good, Doug, and I believe last session or at e-board, that there is a graph that shows the debt service over time, and it might be well to include that for members to put it in perspective. I believe that there is that graph because I requested it, I believe, at one of our e-board sessions or something like that, but it will differentiate between what is going into retired debt and what's actually going to other places. So it might help for the new members.
And then the next page is, again, just sort of a consequence, and these are the change in FTE over that time, or from the early 90s to the governor's budget for 05-07. You'll see the increase in corrections. This gets to be a little messy, but it does show a slight increase in judicial branch, and Senator Devlin was right. Even though their proportional share has fallen, there has been growth in all these agencies.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Doug, Chair Lady, I think that I'm having a problem as a new member of the legislature and going through a session. FTEs by themselves don't mean anything unless you put a salary on them. If you've got all generals and no sergeants, so I think we, as a legislator, we really need to start looking at the rank or the not the rank, but the salary of these FTEs. If they're all at the entry level and $20,000, that's a lot different than someone making $100,000. So to give me numbers that say these are my FTEs, that doesn't help me make decisions unless you have a salary with that.
As we get into the detail within each of these agencies, representative, we'll have the opportunity to tease out that level of detail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, the rest of the pages in this packet I took from the presentation document from yesterday just to quickly go over some of the major issues since we ran out of time yesterday in that joint hearing. And these are what we see as the key budget issues to the Department of Corrections. Growth in the prison population by just under 1,000 or by 77.2% during the upcoming biennium. And just to also note that the community corrections budget has a cut in it, which is really a net cut of $9 million. I won't go into the details on that, but it does provide the opportunity for counties to opt out of the program. For the new members, if you need a description of that, that will come pretty soon when we get to the Department of Corrections budget. On the next page, in terms of the judicial department, I think the BAM staff on the other day described sort of the differences between how the budget for the judicial department is established in the governor's budget versus the executive branch agencies, and there is a difference. But as a result, the governor's budget, as it's set right now, has almost a $25 million, what we'll call a hole in the judicial department, in their what we call their essential budget level, from what they need to provide the services they have today and what's in the governor's budget.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, does in part of that budget for the judicial department, there is the surcharge on filing fees that I believe sunsets June 30th of this year. Could you get us the number for if those continued as they currently are, what revenue would be generated by that?
Actually, I think the next bullet, and I'm not the expert on the judicial branch, Robin is, but the next bullet does say that that the governor's budget doesn't restore the ballot measure 30 reductions, or does it address the $6.6 million required to restore that, what I think is what you're referring
right
to. So it's $6.6 million.
Members, what I would say at this point, this being given consideration to the time and the other major item we have on our agenda, which is the Administration of Justice presentation. Again, we're going to be getting into a great deal of detail when we have the agencies before us. What Mr. Wilson is attempting to do now is just a high-level overview of the key budget issues. Not wanting to cut off your questions, but if we can move quickly through this, it would be helpful.
Madam Chair, you were very diplomatic.
Thank you.
Going on, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Public Defense Services Commission, and often that is called indigent, the largest share is often called indigent defense for their budget. There is a whole, what we'll define as a hole in their budget between the essential budget level and what's in the governor's budget of almost $16 million. And so that gives you an idea there. Again, like judicial departments, they did not restore all of the ballot measure 30 cuts that were approved to be filled by the January 2005 emergency board. So those cuts were restored for 03, 05, but not restored in the governor's budget for 05, 07. So you have a challenge there to deal with also. Oregon State Police, the key budget issues there. There's roughly $70 million of lottery funds used to backfill the general fund in the patrol division and the Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Division. I won't try to. I thought Craig Campbell, the governor's rep, did a fine job of the rationale of explaining the use of lottery funds for this yesterday in front of the full committee. It was a stretch, I must say. but that's not the only place in state police budget. There's also a significant reduction in terms of detective positions in the criminal division. There's a net or a loss of 21 positions. There's also a gain of 8 positions in the division for a policy batch that the governor has in for the meth initiative. But the cut in detective positions will affect generally the major crime and major drug team operations across the state. Oregon Youth Authority on the next page. The governor's budget maintains 850 closed custody beds, but that is not the sufficient amount to meet the forecast amount that the Department of Administrative Services provides. It would take another $40 million in this budget to meet that or to fully fund that portion of the budget, which would mean about 350 more beds, as well as the community services that go along with that population. Am I right on that, Bob? Again, the Youth Authority is not one of my agencies, so Sheila Baker, who handles that for our office. And Department of Justice, their general fund programs are roughly cut roughly by 10%. That includes district attorney assistance, the organized crime offices, Medicaid fraud, victims assistance, and defense of criminal convictions. One issue that you may have in front of you at some point in time will dealing with the criminal fines and assessment. The governor's budget took a different route for those that understand that and replaced all what we call CFAA funding with general fund. That approach I know is being discussed by others in the building that may want to take a different direction in that. And there may be some discussion of that, and that will affect some of the programs in Department of Justice, as well as to the page, the next page, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. This is actually the budget probably in terms of percentage grows the most, but it's based on basically three factors. The new facility is being built about a mile east of here on the other side of the freeway, the new DPSST facility. The cost of the new debt service, the operation of that facility, as well as the going from the current 10 weeks to 16 weeks for the basic police training course, adds roughly $15 million in the governor's budget. But those are all assumptions that are based on past legislative decisions about building that facility and moving to a 16-week course even at 16 weeks, we are about 6 weeks below, 6 or 7 weeks below the national average for the standard police training. On the last page is just a reference page for you. It's a legal sheet, but it provides some history of funding and FTE for four biennia, and you can use that at your leisure. I'm not going to go through that for all the agencies that are covered in this subcommittee. And, Madam Chair, that concludes what I need to talk
about. Thank you, Wilson. Members, if you will go with me now to item three, subcommittee chair expectations and goals, and I would just say briefly that I have enjoyed meeting and talking with each of you in preparation for our committee work. I would like to ask your help in looking as deeply as we possibly can at the agencies in this committee. I'm asking, first of all, that Senator Winters, Representative Hansen, and Representative Hanna, if you will, to work with me in drafting principles that we will use to determine budget priorities. I have a draft that I'll share with you now. You can discard it, start again. It's just something to work from. But again, I ask your assistance in starting our work or beginning to look at principles to guide our work. I would ask Representative Hansen and Hannah to also help me and help this committee look closely at the Judicial Department budget and to assist in leading that discussion when the agency is before us. I want to acknowledge that Representative Wisnot has already started looking at the Homeland Security Agency, and I would ask that the information that you provided to me, Representative, feel free to provide that to the rest of the committee. And we have the director here, and we can let him be aware of what you're doing on behalf of the committee. I would ask Senator Winters and any other member of the committee who's interested to work with me in looking deeply at the Department of Corrections and, again, being a part of leading the discussion when the time comes to look at that agency. And then the other thing I would say to us members is that we have an opportunity. We're looking at a great deal of information in what is really a short span of time in the way in which our legislative sessions are structured. And so we have the opportunity to help each other learn. I'm asking that we question our assumptions, that we question the status quo, that we ask lots of questions. So know that this is a committee where you can feel free to do that. We will start on time, 1 o'clock sharp. And if you cannot be present, we just ask that you provide the courtesy to the chair to let me know that. With that said, I'd like to spend just a few minutes with each of us introducing ourselves, and it's a way of introducing ourselves to those who are getting ready to come forward and talk to us so that they know a little bit more about who we are and what our interests are and where we come from. And I would like to start to my left with Representative Hanna, if you would start us off. And again, I know we all have a book and a story to tell, but we do have these good people, agencies with us, and we all have other opportunities to talk to each other.
Five sentences or less, or are we just...
I'll be brief.
A minute or two.
I'll be brief.
All right.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Good afternoon. I am Bruce Hanna. I'm from House District 7. I represent an area, a greater part of northeastern Douglas County, clear from the Tiller, which is in the far east and south of Douglas County, to northern eastern portions of Lane County, from the Leeburg Dam east on Highway 126, from Lowell on Highway 58 to the top of the mountain, and then all the way out to Loon Lake, if you've ever been out there with your family, out the Umpqua River and jump over into the Smith River drainage and come up through a whole bunch of tree farm country. So I have metropolises like Cottage Grove and Sutherland as my major cities. I have a lot of people that I represent from the Roseburg that have Roseburg addresses, but I'm on the north side of the North Umpqua River covering those addresses. I'm married. I have a beautiful wife and three children, one of whom is a senior at the University of Oregon, and one who's making pizza in Eugene, who's a musician, and a fifth grader at home who's commuting back and forth. And I'm proud to say, since my political aspirations have come along, she is also a school representative, so she's maybe stepping in the way. I'm pleased to be a part of the Ways and Means process in general, and more specific to the public safety agencies. I told Senator Gordley I've never been incarcerated as we talk about these things. That's probably a good thing. And my limited experience with visiting prisons has been through prison ministry with a motorcycle group, and that's all been in California. So I have been to prison, but I had the opportunity to take my motorcycle, and that made it actually a fun experience in prison, if you can have one.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the audience, I represent District 53, which is all of Deschutes County, rural Deschutes County, excluding the city of Bend. I had the pleasure of being appointed September the 5th after the last session, so all those cuts, I didn't have anything to do with. But I had the great experience of serving in the interim on both the Education and the Judiciary Committee, which are my subcommittees for the Ways and Means, and I'm very excited about having that background and knowing most of the terms, although I appreciate what our chair set up for us in orientation with public human services. And I actually did learn a couple new things about drug court and mental health court that I didn't know about, and a citizen review board. So I'm still learning. Real fast, my experience, I'm retired military. I was a diplomat, I was a spy, and a politician. So we can talk more about that. I look forward to working on public safety. I think public safety is the primary purpose of government after serving 27 years in the military. And I actually was not arrested, but I was taken in by the police in Croatia during the war up there, when, and I hollered diplomatic immunity, and they finally let me go. And I have seen the Deschutes County. I had the pleasure of working with Mr. Campbell. I'm on the Commission for Children and Families in Deschutes County. I was chair for 2 years and vice chair for 1 year, and I'm still on the commission, and I've been down to the State Commission on Children and Families.
Excellent. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gary Hansen from, I represent north and a portion of northeast Portland. This is my second time on this committee, so I've got a little bit of a flavor for what lies ahead. It's going to be incredibly challenging as well as incredibly important. My background before I came to the legislature, I was county commissioner, which involved a lot of public safety work with our sheriff's department, corrections, the judiciary of Multnomah County. So I think I've got a fairly good flavor for this. I don't think we really need to go into incarceration records and things of that ilk. We can just skip right over that.
I don't want to take the notes here.
Anyway, I'm very, very glad to serve on this committee.
Senator Devitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my second time on this subcommittee. I look forward to working with all of you, and particularly with the chair of the committee. I don't feel slighted at all that the chair did not list me on some of these special committees, because I think the chair knows that I have my own cross to bear in this process, being the subcommittee chair of education.
One thing I did want to say is that I could talk a lot about my family. I have a wife of over 30 years and three grandchildren and two children. But one of the things I'd like to say, given the audience that's here, is we often talk in this building about our respect for the law enforcement officers, particularly police officers, state troopers, etc. And I, too, share that respect. But I also want to bring to this some respect for those people that work inside institutions in corrections, whether they're in the Department of Corrections or whether they're in the Oregon Youth Authority. I did spend a number of years behind bars in a much earlier life, both in adult and juvenile facilities. And so I think I have some idea for what it is like to work within those facilities, and I have a great deal of respect for both the men and women that work in those facilities.
Senator Winters.
I'm Senator Winters, and probably so much has been written about me over time and being involved with both on the executive side of government as well as the now the policy side of government. You're in my district. I represent District 10, which is Salem, Monmouth, Independence, and Almsville, and Turner. I feel like I'm a part of the chronologically advantaged group sitting up here. Because I've had so much history of when we used to have the juvenile piece as a part of the Department of Human Services, which I was with then in Children's Services Division. It's now split over in Corrections. I was involved when we did the study of OWCC to give women a place to where they weren't a part of the male system. This is the first time, however, that I've served on the Budget Committee. And I'm looking, to thank you, Senator Gordley, for giving me some additional tasks, because between this budget and the Department of Human Services budget, I think it's probably two of the most complex budgets that we have here in the state. And there it's also, and I don't want to diminish the discussion here, because it's probably, in my estimation, two of the most important. That doesn't mean that education isn't. But when you look at the funding streams and you look at the impacts and implication, you're serving and having to make some decisions that will be very, very far-reaching and impacting citizens of this state. I would have to echo, which, by the way, when he was in corrections, he worked with my son, out at who was a correctional officer out at OSCI. So this shows you how this chronologically advantaged person that sits up here is beginning to date herself. But having said that, I too...
We were both in just barely out of our teens at that time.
Yes, and I was... but having said that, there are some challenges ahead of us, and I told Mike and Miller when we didn't have to have the discussion about the state police and the ability to fund troopers, because then they were the funding sources with gasoline tax, and so they were removed, and now we're having some of those issues that we have to face, which says to me how important it is that we make good public policy and that the decisions that we make here are going to have some lasting impacts and implications and the people whose jobs, who work in our correctional institutions and who are out there, the police officers, who are helping to make us safe. As you know, methamphetamine is one of my hot button issues this session, that I think we've got a tremendous job to do to make certain that citizens in this state are not only safe, but they were able to treat those individuals to put their families and states back together. So with that, Senator Gordley, I think they know probably more about me than I know about myself.
Just to share a little bit about my background, this is my third time serving on the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. Served a couple of sessions when I was a member of the House of Representatives. Looking back in my career and over a span of 30 years, I've had some different experiences in the public safety and administration of justice arena that have shaped my thinking about these public policy issues. I was an administration of justice major with an emphasis on corrections at Portland State University. Former Senator Menas and I share the same university in our background and he was also someone who went through that program. I've served as director of a couple of youth programs. One program, Portland House of Emoja, working with young men transitioning out of gang activity. Another youth program run by the Urban League that works with young people who are having difficulty navigating school, a program for adjudicated youth. At one time, I served as a volunteer coordinator for what we call the Northeast Rescue Plan Action Committee. This grew out of a group of citizens who were just fed up with drugs and gangs and other manifestations of crime in the neighborhood. It was a multifaceted approach. We put together neighborhood watch, block watch. At one point, we even called for the presence of the National Guard. That was during the Goldschmidt era, because gang activity was just out of control. I've served as chair of the Chiefs Forum, police advisory body up in Portland. Under now mayor, when Tom Potter was chief, graduated from the Portland Police Bureau Citizens Academy, and I will tell you that when my turn came on the firing range to hold that gun and fire, I couldn't do it. And I still remember that experience. I've served on the National Organization for Victims Assistance. I have been a victim, a rape victim, served as a volunteer rape victim advocate with Multnomah County DA's office, served with my county's public safety policy council, and also have had a career in corrections, working as a counselor in a work release facility for women at a time when the state invested resources in work release and transitioning men and women out of prison and back into community settings. Served on the governor's board on drug and violent crime for about three terms, and have worked for the past 10 years with Chief Justice Carson's access to justice work, which is dealing with disparities in our justice system. I'm just very pleased to have this opportunity to work with all of you in looking at our public safety system. And I think we're just very fortunate to have our partners with us this afternoon. And at this point, I'd like to call up Craig Campbell to help us transition into the next discussion. What we have, members, is an opportunity to look at three things this afternoon. What is the state of the administration of justice in Oregon 2005 through the perspective of these different public safety partners? What are the challenges, the trends, the critical issues needing immediate examination and action? And secondly, what is the one thing that this legislature must accomplish this session? And then the opportunity to hear some discussion of examples of partnership between these agencies. And again, it's an opportunity for us to better understand that we do have a system and to move us away from thinking about the system or the pieces of it in silos. I hope that's clear in terms of the intent of the discussion. And Craig, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, wanted to first of all thank you for inviting us to come and start off these presentations today. As I'm sure all of you are very aware, especially as we've gone through the last few years, that if policy doesn't drive budget, budget does have a tendency to drive policy. And so I very much applaud your efforts to look at principles for prioritizing funding for the public safety budget. I want to indicate, first of all, that we're very cognizant of the challenges that you have ahead of you and want to make sure that you understand that both from myself, from the governor's office, and those who are sitting behind me and will be presenting to you as well next week, we stand ready to assist you in any way you deem necessary, and we will provide you the best information we can and in the most objective fashion that we can, so that as you are struggling with the policy issues around the budget, you should never feel as though you don't have good information to make those decisions. Obviously, you're well served by your Alico staff, who's been a great partner with us as we've been looking at things like the governor's budget and our policy development as well. I do want to share with you that my job as being the governor's public safety advisor, my job is to work with the people behind us on setting public safety policy for the state through the governor's office. And I want to tell you, one of the greatest joys I have is the fact that the caliber of individuals that we have serving as the directors, deputy directors, and employees of our state agencies are truly phenomenal. They represent a very broad depth, very proactive, and open-minded approach to looking at public safety. And one of the things, Madam Chair, that you mentioned that is so critically important is that we take a tremendous amount of effort to look at this as a system, not as a series of silos or a series of agencies, because we know that each one in turn relies upon its neighbors to do its job effectively. So you will be hearing a recurring theme from the individuals who are coming up to talk to you today about their interrelationship, their dependence upon one another, and how they benefit from each other's wisdom, and would, of course, recommend that you take full advantage of the wisdom and experience that they bring to the table. There are going to be some themes that I'm sure you're going to hear, and I'll start out by indicating that there are some overarching themes that impact the public safety system, and want to also, as I do that, point out that as much as we need to look at public safety as a system, public safety is very much an integral part of the overall system of government services, including the human services element, education, and other agencies as well. The public safety system itself, of course, is composed of the juvenile justice system, the criminal justice system, the emergency response system, and Homeland Security. And they all fit amongst one another rather closely. Those major themes that are going to be impacting us as a system, of course, is maintaining a level of balance throughout. We saw as we went through budget cuts that there are certain linchpins within that system that if they fail or if they aren't adequately addressed, they can make the rest of the system fail as well. Also, we're facing some additional challenges this time that have been growing. One of course, is the one that you're all intimately familiar with, and that's the challenge of methamphetamine, which is a problem that impacts far more than the public safety system, and also the mental health system, because we rely a great deal on the mental health system being able to address those who would otherwise fall afoul of the criminal justice system. And I'm sure you will hear a great amount from both our state agency folks and our local partners that those difficulties have had a tremendous impact on the effectiveness and activities in the public safety system. So with that, unless there are any particular questions, I would be very happy to now turn it over to those who, on a day-to-day basis, make sure that the public safety system is running as efficiently as effectively as possible.
Let's do that.
I think the first person we have coming up is Joan Minnis, who is the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
I'm not sure, with your permission, I'm going to bring up the deputy director.
Oh, certainly. And welcome.
Suffice it to say, Madam Chair, I'm very nervous.
Thank you for sitting through the organizational part of our meeting. Breathe deeply and exhale.
I'm going to, and Madam Chair, I do want to honor the committee.
Senator Lynn, don't we have a whole list of questions prepared ahead of time to give?
No, those are for the next time.
Is that for the next time?
Madam Chair, when you're going to have time. I do appreciate the candor and the laughter of those that perhaps didn't serve with me and the other members in the legislature. It's a privilege for me to be in the position I am today, having an opportunity to speak to you about the department that I am the director of. My name is John Minnis. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Chair Gordley, you asked a number of questions of us, which we've tried to constrain our answer, which is often difficult for us given the complexity of the agency and the mission of the agency. So I wanted to start off by sharing with you, and there should be a handout that you have with a bit of a little dissertation and some handouts that will help us go through this. But the mission of the agency is... The mission of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is to promote, and I underline the word excellence in public safety by delivering quality training and by developing and upholding professional standards. However, our statutory mandate, Chapter 181 of the Oregon Revised Statute, speaks largely toward the development and implementation of minimum standards for public safety disciplines subject to the Act. Last session, the 2003 session of the legislature did add a set of findings to Chapter 181 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which I've highlighted in the memorandum, and it, in essence, indicates that these findings are that providing high-quality training for public safety personnel enhances the quality of the public safety services provided to communities, contributes significantly to the safety of public safety officers, and reduces state, local, and individual liability. Basic training for public safety personnel provides a consistent foundation, and I put that in italics because it's important, of the best practices, knowledge, and skills necessary for public safety officers throughout the state. Advanced leadership and continuing training preserve and build on the knowledge and skills acquired during basic training, ensuring that communities continue to have well-trained professional public safety officers. Advanced leadership and continuing training should be consistent with recognized best practices while meeting specific local needs, and course and instructor accreditation help to ensure that advanced leadership and continuing training programs are consistent with recognized best practices and are legally sufficient. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training may continue to accredit advanced leadership and continuing training courses and programs consistent with Chapter 181. So I wanted to start out after opening, giving that background, identifying kind of the disparate nature of what our mission is versus what the statutes ask us to do. It seems to be, at least in my view, a bit of a glaring issue. I did also put the vision statement for the organization in the back. This is two-sided copying. It says that DPSST will be the leader in developing skilled, ethical, underlying ethical, public safety professionals who are respected in their communities as they work to ensure that Oregonians are safe and secure where they live, go to school, work, and play. This last year, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training went through an exercise with the entire department in which we identified a set of values that the agency wanted to subject itself to, submit itself to, and agree to live by. The first one that that was identified was integrity, and it was further defined as following the highest ethical standards in our working relationships, practices, and decisions. The second one was excellence, dedicated to the highest quality, both in our individual actions and as an organization. Third one, an important one for me, is customer service, working proactively to meet the needs of our constituents, stakeholders, and one another. Fourth one, respect, regarding others with honor and valuing their varied roles, contributions, and viewpoints. Accountability, understanding that we are responsible to constituents, stakeholders, and one another in our everyday work and in pursuing our mission. Communication, speaking and listening openly, honestly, consistently, consistently to further our mission and build trust into our relationships. And the last one is employee development, that we're committed to developing a well-trained, competent, and reliable workforce that abides by the organization's values, is empowered for personal and professional growth, and is recognized for service to constituents, stakeholders, and one another. Hopefully it establishes a foundation for who we are in terms of what our mission is and what our vision statement is, and more concise than the larger vision document that I prepared earlier in the year, and then also what our values are intended to be. We do have a little bit of a handout that looks like this. It's just a fairly simple document regarding what we do, and I'd like to go through that if I can. And the important part of this, I think I'm going to shift to Eric, because Eric's developed it, and I'm going to
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Eric Gavlis. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The challenge of who we are and what we do is illustrated very well on this circle. But before we get to the circle, we need to start at the middle. And that is that through legislative action and years of working with our constituent groups and the communities, the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training was created many years ago to really set minimum standards
for the training, employment, and certification of public safety personnel. A few years ago, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training was created basically to carry out that work. Years ago, the board and the department were one entity, and there was a differential shift made to let the agency take care of day-to-day business, and the board doesn't get involved in personal matters, those kind of things. The department handles that. But the larger part out of that center goes those two different areas that I talked about, one being standards on the top for employment certification and training of those officers, whether they are in a volunteer fire department or in a correctional facility or in a law enforcement agency, for what they needed to be hired, trained, and certified in. Then the bottom is the training mission, which is basic or entry-level training for those officers, regional training, the ongoing training of those perishable skills across the state, and the leadership training for those people that lead those people in those agencies. And then that second ring really is that group that we get at. And if you think of an incident that happens anywhere in the state, the 911 center is where that call is most of the times reported. We train and certify those people to handle that first call. Those people then send a police officer or a fire response. We train and certify those police officers. Then if there's an arrest made, those corrections officers that handle the processing, the intake. Then finally, when that person's released, a parole probation officer. We train and certify all of those different professionals. And then if you continue on that sort, there's two other entities, although not involved in administrative justice directly, but local fire departments, and also private security professionals that actually are a largely growing industry, 4-to-1 currently, police versus fire. I'm sorry, police versus private security. So really our mission is very large and very complex, and all of those groups really live in one agency, being the department and the board.
Thank you, thank you, Eric. Madam Chair, I'd just like to continue. In addition, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training serves as the primary basic training program for virtually all Oregon police departments, sheriffs, corrections, 911, emergency communications, parole and probation, as well as, these are a few little addendums here, campus public safety, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and animal control officers who are special agents under a specific statute appointed by the governor, making them police officers. There are several exceptions. One, the Oregon State Police currently conducts their own academy at Camp Rylea in Northwest Oregon. And in the past, the Portland Police Bureau, Eugene Police Department, Multnomah County, and a few others have conducted their own basic training programs. But the general trend right now is a migration towards the centralized academy system for the purpose of basic training. DPSST is both the training agency and the regulatory agency, ensuring compliance with board-mandated standards for training and for professional conduct. DPSST also provides regional training to firefighters in rural communities where the vast majority of personnel are volunteer, and the funding comes from the fire insurance premium tax. You might know that there are a few missing elements in this document, which I put together, and I take full blame for that. It might also be interesting to note that Eric is a firefighter. He's not a police officer and comes from a fire background. And just as a footnote, 60% of what we currently do in our agency as far as academy classes is, in fact, corrections work. So when most people think about the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training or the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, the first thing that comes to mind is it's the police academy. Well, it is, but it's much bigger than that in terms of our mission and the folks that we serve. DPSST also regulates the private security industry through the Private Security Act that was enacted in 1995, and the funding is generated through fees charged for licensure or certification, and also through civil penalties that might be assessed for violators of the Act.
John, Senator Wenderson, representing the panel.
Question, because I'm just really floored. I mean, we're really so progressive in Oregon, and we usually like to toot our horn as to how we're leading the rest of the nation. And then I'm looking at seeing that the 400 hours, depending on how you want to put that category before we were embarking on this, it would make us either 48th or 43rd.
Or you must be referring.
Yeah, I'm referring to your little graph in here. And do the other states, do they also include fire?
Madam Chair, and Senator Winters, in response, this is actually data that we just received today from IADLAS, which is the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training, otherwise known as POST organizations in most other states. Most other states have it's a police officer standards and training organization. Very few of them have fire service training. Many of them do not have corrections components, but there's a trend towards corrections components becoming part of state organizations. And in fact, post organizations vary around the nation in terms of what they actually do. California is an example where the post organization is largely a conduit for money. And most of the academies are conducted at a local level by a consortium of agencies and through community colleges that might be part of their program. Their system is very different.
But if I look at where we rank here among the other states, it doesn't say nice things, I think. And I'll just say, you know, it's where we've had this issue of the needs, and particularly how the police department is able to interact with citizens and all these other things in training. And I didn't know we were down here at 48th, or you could look at it at 43rd. So thank you for the graph.
Madam Chair, and Senator Winters, the legislature has seen fit to, quite frankly, spend a very large amount of money building a very good facility for training.
In my district.
That's correct. And it is envisioned to, in January of 2007, our budget is predicated upon going to a 16-week basic training program, which is not, and this is a very important component part, we are transitioning, as many other states are, after a model, I believe, originated at FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Georgia, involving our training in more scenario-based, real-life enactment training, which takes the material that folks are getting in their classroom activities and then applying those activities in scenarios designed to reinforce the various themes that might be part of the training. Ethics might be an issue in a scenario, or cultural competency might be a portion of one of those, or a combination of that plus a mental health issue. And the expansion to the 16-week program, and one of the reasons, as you look at our budget through the process, that drives much of the cost has to do with the number of individuals necessary to develop scenarios, enact scenarios, and oversee skills-related training. Obviously, if you're just doing classroom training, one class instructor in a classroom will do, but if you're doing skills training in a firearms training center, it takes a few more people to make sure that it's being done safely. If you're doing emergency vehicle operations training, it takes a few more people. And if you're doing defense tactics training, where you're actually teaching hand-to-hand combat or ground fighting techniques and such, it takes even more people. Of course, firearms training, we certainly want to make sure that we don't have individuals injured or hurt in the process of being trained. So as we move towards skills venues and skills training, the number of individuals necessary to oversee and participate in that training modality does increase. And so that will be one of the issues I'm sure we'll pursue.
We will definitely get into a level of detail when you're back. Representative Hanna?
I'll be brief, Madam Chair. Did I understand that the private security force and or potentially private corrections forces is growing faster than public sector training? Did you say that? I think I understood that. And so it's a two-part question. So if that's the case, are you providing that training for a fee?
I think I understand the question, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna. The private security sector is self-supported, and their training is fairly de minimis. It's roughly an 8-hour class that's taught, and the folks that are in the private security section take a test. Once they've taken the test successfully, they've completed a background check, then they can continue in their careers, basically, unless they do something that would otherwise cause them to be revoked. But what I think I'm talking about is corrections employees. As you might have heard, the number of prisons, there's a number of growth in prison beds, hence more corrections officers and such on and so forth, and we train all of the corrections officers with the Department of Corrections and also local sheriffs. We do not have any private prisons in Oregon or private corrections.
That's kind of where I was. I understand. Thank you.
Director Minnis, what I would like to do, given that you've put a lot of effort into giving us a written document, which we will definitely be reading and putting together with the other documents that describe the work of your agency, if you would go right to the challenges and your statement about the status of the administration of justice.
Thank you. I will, and I'll refer you to, unfortunately it's not stapled together, the National Institute of Justice 2004 study on hiring and keeping police officers, an interesting document that is, I think, consistent with Oregon's experience. But let's go to the challenges, increasing demands for basic and regional training programs, both in terms of quality, content, and consistency throughout Oregon. There is an IATLIS document. Well, this is the one we're referring to here that has the graph with the number of training hours. Migrating from an attitude of providing minimally adequate training to a higher quality model of excellence. The transition towards scenario-based training that is realistic and valued by the public and by our constituents. Recruitment and retention of public safety professionals, again referring to the NIJ study. Diversity of DPSST staff and cultural competency within public safety agencies throughout Oregon, and the emotional survival of officers in their careers, and parenthetically, especially post-trauma, that result in a high suicide rate. And at this point, I don't have a document to give to you, but I would like to read some statistics here just to give you kind of a sense of what's going on nationally. The National Law Enforcement Memorials Fund basically tracks the number of suicides by police officers, and just as a matter of course, there are roughly 50 to 60 officers feloniously killed in the line of duty nationally in the United States. Last year, there were 484 police officers who committed suicide. In fact, if you look at the rates, in 2000, there were 418 who committed suicide. 2001, there were 430. 2002, there were 450. In 2003, there were 484. And I say emotional survival of police officers, public safety workers, because it is a challenge for our training to ensure that people who are engaged in public safety careers maintain a balance in their lives. It's an area of training that, quite frankly, has not been focused on a lot. But what we're seeing is a trend of increasing suicides by police officers and other public safety professionals because of the various stresses in the job. We think that there's an element of training that can focus on those issues and potentially save the lives of individuals working in public safety. In conclusion, I concluded this by saying that the status of the Administration of Justice from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training perspective is that we are training to a minimally adequate level in most, if not all, public safety disciplines. The legislature has provided significant resources and direction in the last several sessions. However, declining revenues at the state and local levels have reduced our ability to be proactive in moving toward our desire to increase professionalism in public safety by improving the levels of training for all disciplines at all levels that are necessary. So the conclusion to question number one. And with your permission,
please move forward.
The second question was, what is the highest priority issue that must be addressed or accomplished by this legislature, this session, and the Administration of Justice? I wrote this that I believe that the most important thing this legislature can accomplish is to understand that the system of administration of justice is interconnected and related, that there's no silver bullet that will fix the system. However, we must improve the professionalism within public safety by increasing access to culturally competent, excellent, high-quality, relevant training. These officers are the front lines that fight against crime and developing healthy communities. But please keep in mind that economic development is related to the safety of a community, and that few businesses are willing to locate in a community that is feared for its level or its actual rate of crime or its perceived level of crime and delinquency. Also, safe schools have a difficult time realistically existing in communities with inadequate public safety, and unfortunately, individuals without resources are often left to live in areas that are blighted and crime-ridden. I indicate that it's fundamentally important that public safety professionals receive ongoing training to replenish perishable skills, and I'd like to reiterate the concept of perishable skills, and that they train in developing best practices and learn new technology that applies to the various disciplines. We can increase the level of professionalism by continuing to provide adequate basic, intermediate, advanced training, as well as supervision and leadership training. This can be accomplished by developing mutually beneficial partnerships with organizations that have similar or related interest in leveraging each other's combined resources and skills. And in addition, the utilization of the new Public Safety Academy facility for integrated discipline training and innovative regional training delivery is a continued goal. I do believe that we can enhance what you see I guess, on the outside, what you read in the newspapers, by increasing the level of professionalism, the level of training that we provide around the state. So, and the third and last point, I'm going to shift over to my beloved friend and Deputy Director.
Thank you. One of the most important things, and your question is right on target, is the partnerships that we have. In addition to all of the agencies that you'll hear from over the next 2 days that are our State Administration of Justice partners, there are many others. An example that I can give you is a child abuse training class that we're developing that might include employees from the Office of Children and Family Services, their CAMI staff, the FBI with their investigators, as well as Oregon State Police and local police officers and investigators. So we work in partnership to not only develop training, but then to deliver it statewide. So that's one example. We rely on our partners for not only instructors, but facilities where we have our offices as well. A big part is where we deliver the training across the state, as well as in the academy, and on the support and development of programs. And one of the largest areas is input and guidance. One of our primary missions, we talk a lot about training, but also the standards to which we hold these professionals to. We have a board, we have a number of advisory committees who really help us direct staff on where those standards should be. For fitness, as far as if you commit a crime, should you still remain in this profession? So we rely a lot on those groups to come in, and they actually help set those standards, and then the department carries that out. And it's an important part, and not just on the public safety side, but also for the private security officers. They do hold these officers to a very high standard because of the value of what these officers do in their communities and in the high regard they're held in, truly. We have a term when the badge is tarnished, should that officer remain working in that community, and then the board and its committees take that very seriously.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you come back for further testimony, could you please address whether you should be training or looking in, or working with the Department of Forestry and firefighting standards, practice, and training for firefighting crews, please?
Madam Chair, it might be internet. We know we already do that to some degree. There's a relationship with the Department of Forestry and our agency.
Follow up.
Certainly.
So please address then, are you involved in certifying crews, the contract crews, or not? Is that just...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, our function from the fire training and certification standpoint is for what we call structural firefighters, members of rural fire protection districts and city fire departments. We do work with Oregon Department of Forestry because, as you know, we have a lot of areas that you hear the term wildland-urban interface, where people now are building further into the forests, but further away from the cities where that fire protection is from. We've worked with forestry as well as United States Forest Service and a number of the federal partners to have a standard in place for those structural firefighters now that are truly going into that interface. So we do certify those firefighters that work for fire districts and city fire departments, but Oregon Department of Forestry trains and certifies their employees as well as the contract crews that may work for them.
That's my question, is could you address that? Should it be, should you be doing it? It seems like it's a mixed staff, no, mixed here. Pardon.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett, you might also want to know that firefighter certification is a voluntary certification, whereas police, corrections, and others are mandatory under statute. So there is no mandatory certification for firefighters.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you. Director Minnis.
Yes, sir.
Just in that highlight of that issue of working with partners, I just wanted to let you know that sometime in the relatively near future, and I'll let the chair know about this, I may be requesting something relative to the relative costs of training and who bears those costs in terms of cost benefits. Ayla, our discussion in the last session.
Could Madam Chair, if I could clarification, because we would like to be able to prepare. And I heard, Senator, that you'd asked this question in an earlier meeting, or
yes,
just raised the issue in talking to my budget director. I can give you at least a quick answer, but I don't think it really gets to the point of the question.
No, probably doesn't. I can give you something in more detail, and I'll run it by the chair
first. I think I hear a different question than was related earlier this morning. So,
whenever we enter into this discussion, it... Representative Patridge started this discussion last session, and I think it's going to come up later in the session, so it's better to be prepared for it early than...
That's great. Madam Chair, Senator, if you don't mind, I'll get an appointment with your office.
Okay.
And visit with you. Perhaps we can get some clarification then.
What you have given us, Director Menace, is some, in my view, some information and that will give us further direction in looking with a laser-like view at the budget issues. I particularly appreciate the way that you stated the conclusion to question number one. That says volumes to me about what we need to keep our eye on. We're training to a minimum, and you have a value statement that says we want to train for excellence, and we've got to consider and look at the quality and the kind of investment we're really going to be willing to make.
Now, Chair, I spoke yesterday afternoon to the Executive Leadership Training Seminar in Seaside, Oregon, and one of the points that I consistently make with those individuals that we interface with is that the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is their servant. We provide a service to organizations that rely on high-quality service and consistency and the reliability of those training programs so that to the extent that we can facilitate their goals, that's what we intend to do. And I'll just leave you with this one thought because it's very important, and that is that you get what you teach for.
Yes.
And if you don't teach, you get chaos. You teach at a minimal level, then it creates problems. And I can basically, I'll try to be somewhat humorous, but it's not at all. And that is that we train for 75% proficiency in most of our academic subjects in our training. But the sad part of that is that means that in 25% of the instances, you can be wrong, at least theoretically. And when you're talking about individual lives or civil rights issues and other issues that are important to our culture, I think that our standards should be higher and we should have a higher expectation of those individuals who are wearing a badge and serving our communities.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to apologize to you because I'm feeling that we have not budgeted enough time for a discussion with you. But you have provided us a document that we can continue to explore with you when you're back before the committee.
Thank you. And if anyone has any additional questions, we're certainly welcome to communicate with our office, and we'll provide that directly to your offices.
And thank you for your leadership.
Thank you.
I think we have Superintendent Rucker. And let's bring up Homeland Security.
Madam Chair, just so you know about Homeland Security, Beverly Stilwell, who is the Director of Homeland Security, is in the family here today at the funeral. Ken Murphy is one of the deputy directors of the agency.
Thank you very much. Please go forward and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ronald Ricker, Superintendent of the Oregon State Police, and I'm very happy to be here and have the opportunity to address your questions. I listened with interest to all of what went on before Mr. Menace and also his comments, which, of course, speaking to the point, one of the points that I want to make, and you're going to hear over and over about the interconnectedness of our work. John Menace made the point, one of the points that I absolutely intended to make, which was the very same thing he ended with, which is the idea of shooting high, aiming high, and striving for the absolute best possible provision of service and levels of standards of training that we can achieve. I'm going to, in the interest of your time and in the interest of my colleagues behind me, I'm going to try to go through rather promptly what I've prepared. I also will provide it to you. I don't have a copy in writing for you today, but it will be over here this afternoon for each of you. But with respect to question number one, I cannot successfully discuss the dynamics of the administration of justice without viewing it as part of an interconnected system and recognize how the various components are related together. The state of the administration of justice and the public safety system in Oregon are a system that is out of balance and is in some areas broken. Examples are many. The disparity of criminal law investigation, for example, versus traffic citation and enforcement, where in many cases people will pay more in fines for a minor traffic violation than a criminal will pay for having committed some much more serious crime. Often policies directed toward public safety problems are not consistently applied nor adequately funded to provide for sustainable results. There is a lack of essential resources such as mental health, social service, and treatment and prevention that reduce crime and inappropriate social behavior. And Oregon has a system, of administration of justice which focuses primarily on incarceration of offenders rather than on front-end strategies at crime prevention and reduction. This, in some cases, is a result of citizen mandates such as ballot measures that have been passed that require that that's what we have to do. I mentioned as a sidelight here, John was talking about the DPSST Academy and Senator Winters commented about the level of training hours. And it was also mentioned that the state police, among other agencies, have conducted our own training academies for a number of years. We are on track to migrate together with DPSST beginning in January of 07, as was mentioned. But currently, State Police Recruit Academy training is more than 800 hours in length. And even with the investments that we all hope to make with the DPSST new academy, it's still going to be just over 600. So we have a ways to go, and it's not going to be possible to invest too much in the training standards and expectations of our public safety officials. So we are working very closely with John and with DPSST and trying to do our level best to support the establishment of the highest possible standards of training for academic discipline and skills training within the new academy when it opens in 07. Today and in the future, there are many challenges facing the greater public safety system and the administration of justice. Ken Murphy's here to talk about Homeland Security and what they're going to be, what the program areas are there. But everybody knows the threat of terrorism is real in this country. It's happened before. Every expert you talk to here or from coast to coast will tell you it's not a matter of if, but when it happens again, and we certainly all have to align our thinking accordingly. We agree with those statements made by John about the challenges in recruiting, hiring, and training and retaining. Notice I said retaining in the state police a diverse and qualified workforce in criminal justice in times of significant demographic shifting. We, like every other agency, are facing large volumes of retirements, and as is the case across the public safety sector, and not just in Oregon but across the nation, the recruitment and hiring of qualified police candidates is a real issue. It's an issue in every part of our nation. So we don't have a problem here in Oregon that's unique, but we do have a problem, and it will continue to be one, at least by all indications.
Given the challenges that officers, both state troopers and correctional officers, all face, is this one of the issues out there in trying to recruit and retain individuals? We've got a different kind of criminal, if you will. You've got the added dimension of methamphetamine and those other drugs that are a lot more aggressive and that the officers are a lot more at risk than they would have been at 30, 40 years ago. Are those some of the elements that...
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, they may be. I think if we look back historically, we see some trends, and when usually you have a big flood of police officer applicants and candidates and people want to get in this business, have been after some of the major wars in the nation's history. You've got a lot of people coming out of the military, and those people find themselves attracted to this, in many cases, to this type of work. I think we've been through a period of time in the last couple of decades prior to the last few years when we didn't have a lot of people coming out of the military looking for work in law enforcement. So I think there's a trend there. I think the comments that you make may very well also be part of that dynamic. I haven't found anybody in my travels throughout the nation and my interaction with my colleagues in every other state police organization. I haven't quite figured this out yet. I'm not sure there's really one or maybe even a couple, but of things. It used to be somebody came to work for a law enforcement organization, and the first day they looked at that as, day one of a 25 or 30-year career. And that's very definitely changing. That's the way I felt when I started. But these people coming to work for us today, they don't necessarily see the world that way. They see Many of them, it will be a lifelong career, but for some of them, they've had two or three substantial jobs before they come to work for us, and you know, they're not exactly sure that it's going to be a 25 or 30 year ride. So there's a whole set of dynamics that I really don't really claim to understand, but it certainly contributes among those things you mentioned, I'm sure, as being factors. And that brings me to the next point about effectively responding to and dealing with this continual change. Sometimes it's change in the environment in which we work, the type of crime, the type of social issues that are going on, and sometimes it's the social attitudes of our prospective employees and our own existing workforce. And probably the most effective challenge to the effective administration of justice in Oregon is providing the essential and priority public safety services during continual times of fiscal uncertainty and budget decline. That's what I was making a little reference to when I talked about retaining our employees. Layoff is a very huge dynamic which clearly affects your ability to retain your workforce. We got, of the 129 we laid off in 2003, we got most of them back. We didn't get them all back. We just graduated a recruit class last Friday, a week ago tomorrow, which represents the balance of what we were not able to hire back of those we laid off. But, you know, we continue to have retirements, and we've got more people to hire yet just to try to stay even. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Just a very quick question, Madam Chair, just a response from the superintendent. It's probably also impacted in terms of if a candidate for a position has a choice between working in some cases for a county or for the state police, thinking about what the long-term prospects are of continuing to employment, hasn't it, to some degree, in terms of what the future is, in terms of how many years they may be retained, given our layoff history in recent years. Maybe it hasn't been as bad as...
Senator Gorley, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the short answer is yes. I think a lot of our people, the state police doesn't pay the highest wage. So these people are, in some cases, are people that just want to be state troopers. And I think that's why we got so many of them back. Yeah. We didn't get them all back. And I think for some of those, they did move on to other police agencies. And basically, some of the feedback we got was, I can't live like this. I've got a family to feed. I've got bills to pay, et cetera. So I can't. The employment situation is too unstable for me to run the risk of coming back and potentially getting laid off again. Yeah. I think that's where we are after layoff number one. If there ever is another one in the future, then I think the point you make is people, even though they may want to be working for the state police, are just not going to be able to take that risk.
Could you comment on morale, current morale in your organization?
I would love to comment on morale, Madam Chair, and I wish I understood this fully. For some reason, morale in the Oregon State Police right now is sky high. People, I think there's something about having gone through what we've gone through as an organization and the fact that there's only 329 of these troopers out there, and that people have been stretched and pushed and asked to do things far beyond what they were accustomed to. There's something about that that has really brought a closeness to the organization. We have a wonderful relationship with the State Police Officers Association and its leadership, and I couldn't be more proud of them. I wish I understood why it was all like this, because it seemed to me 4 or 5 years ago would have been a lot better time to have great morale in the State Police, but we didn't. And it's very, very good. It's very good. And another example is it used to be we have a promotion, an opportunity for a promotion to come along. Someone may be going to leave the represented ranks and go into management where they're unprotected. Not many years ago, there'd be occasions when people wouldn't put in for promotion because they just didn't want to move or they didn't want to take those. Now we have a promotion opportunity come along, and there's people lining up. They want those jobs. They want to be part of the leadership of the organization. So I don't fully understand it, but it's very good. Having said that, they're looking at me and they're looking at you, hoping for better days ahead, and with some sincere hope that materializes.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Question number two, what is the highest priority issue that must be addressed or accomplished by this legislative session? We need to formally develop a long-term funding strategy for essential public safety system services that will result in the greatest impact. There are many investment areas that can have immediate and visible impacts, such as crash reductions on the Oregon State and Interstate Highways, clearing up DNA backlogs and felony crime hits in our forensics area. We need to take both a short and long-term view of the system to effectively address many of the weaknesses within the administration of justice in Oregon. Legislators need to resist the temptation to implement initiatives that only create change this session or are aimed at just this biennium. And, for example, if I may make a point on that, everything that's funded by the general fund, whether it's in the state police or some other agency in the public safety sector, everything that rests on it that's funded, certainly all that's funded in whole by the general fund, all of that there were disappropriations and there were reductions. Well, those might not necessarily have been the places where one would have wanted to make reductions. It doesn't lend one, in my budget, for example, the things that I have that are funded totally on general fund, for example, in the 0305 biennium, patrol and forensics, whether you want to argue which one's number one or which one's number two, they're clearly the most two important functions that the state police provides. Both of them are almost exclusively reliant on general funds. And so when the budget crises have happened over the last few years, that's where the reductions came. No one had any other alternative. But yet I've got other things where the funding is not from the general fund, and the funding is stable, and we're doing fine. Well, if I would have had, or if you would have had the opportunity to prioritize how those adjustments were made, we might have done differently. So the funding source becomes what drives what you cut or what you grow, not whether or not it might fit on one's independent evaluation of the priority of those services.
They call it the hydraulic.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so I think that affects us system-wide. I think it's affected every other public safety agency in here, not just mine. So now we're two or three cycles of reductions removed from that, and that's how I think we've gotten very much out of balance.
Sure.
The last thing, the effect of that is you end up, we all say we're not going to do it, but you have the effect of thinning the soup, and you have to within the funding areas, whether you want to or whether we would have wanted to or not. The last thing I'll say is that what is the most valuable service that your public safety partners provide to assist in your mission? The public safety community is just back and forth with all kinds of partnerships. We provide a crime lab, criminal justice information sharing systems, specialized criminal investigations, the forensics, on and on. That's what we provide to other people. They do the same with us because a lot of these things are worked in partnership. People talk about duplication of services, and to me, duplication of services is if Ken went out and did something today, and I go out and do the very same thing today that he did tomorrow, and the same thing gets done twice. Well, that's a duplication because it's already been done. But if he goes and does something today and I do the same thing tomorrow but with a different victim, it's not duplication. It's we divided the work up and we got it done. And so I think that there's a lot of discussion about that, and rightfully so. We don't want to be duplicating services and doing things redundantly with other public safety partners, nor do they with us. But collectively, I would argue, and I think most of my partners, if not all of them, would agree, if you take every, let's just talk about the police side of this, take every police agency, city, county, state, federal, whatever, every uniform you've got of every color and location, you still don't have too many. So, in fact, there's a very good argument for you don't have enough. So the idea that it does drive up the reason why we shouldn't go out and redundantly do work, but it does mean we do need to partner, and that we may be doing some of the same things in different places and at different times, to me, is just that's everybody rolling up their sleeves, working together and not getting hung up about, semantics. I think the public deserves, if they've got an emergency or they've got a problem and there's a police officer down the street, then and they're the closest one, that's who they should get. Mm-hmm. And who cares what color their uniform is. Right. So,
I want to do just a little time check right here and say that it's very clear to me, members, that these are conversations that really deserve more time and need to go forward. And so I'm going to be working with our staff, Doug Wilson, to look at how we can extend the conversation to next week. I appreciate that we have partners still in the audience who have not yet had an opportunity to speak, but I think your presence and your listening as well is helpful. Shake your heads if you agree with me. You can go the other way if you disagree. You will not be penalized. But it. Speaking for myself, but what we're having here, at least from the perspective of this member, is a very rich and useful beginning conversation about all of these issues. It's going to help us in our. In our decision making. So just hang with us, if you will, and we'll hear from everyone. Did you move to your point of conclusion?
Yes, I had, Madam Chair, and I if I would answer any questions or pass to Mr. Murphy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the content. Sir?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy, and I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon's Office on Homeland Security and also the Director of Oregon Emergency Management. I think I would first lead into answering the questions although I've had some people ask me, and you have to take a look at how the Office of Homeland Security affects the administration of justice, but... As I've learned in my short tour in state government, working for Superintendent Ricker and the state police in emergency management, and now with the advent of Homeland Security, that we really do touch a great deal of the administration of justice. Some of the issues, we don't necessarily get that close to or have any direct effect upon. But it's very clear, as I see Homeland Security mature, that there's more and more effects that will take place dependent upon which pathways Homeland Security moves forward. And I also want to keep in your mind also, as we talk about Homeland Security, I think we all have a perception of what that means, but we still have the need to make sure that we take care of all hazards across our state, and that truly does affect all of the public safety agencies and the administration of justice. I'll start out first by letting you know the administration of justice, I can tell you in Homeland Security, Emergency Management, and those organizations that make up this organization, we've had to be interconnected. That is our only way of survival. We've been very aggressive at dealing with partners in the public safety arena, and many partners now that have really never spent much time in the public safety arena because Homeland Security has brought them in. And I think really, you know, the state of administration of justice from the Homeland Security perspective is, I think this will be another set of tools and another set of disciplines and people when you go outside the traditional public safety arena and you bring in public health and the food, the agriculture, all the different areas where we've been focusing Homeland Security efforts. And it has brought an awareness into all of these different disciplines, which I think has caused us to be better interconnected and ultimately supporting the public safety efforts of administering justice. It's very key that everybody, you know, understands what basic public safety is, and that way that's what's helped us in my office in Homeland Security, because we know the needs of the public safety agencies, the courts, the judicial system, so that we can support it in any way, shape, or form, because we depend upon these people
that are going to help save the lives and protect the property of our state, whether it's terrorism or tsunamis or floods or fires or earthquakes. The one thing I do want to say about the state of administration, Homeland Security is a very fast-moving subject matter. I will say, even though I wouldn't want to use the word threatened, it causes the system of public safety to change quite a bit as we develop law at the federal level or new things are determined as a terrorist threat to our society. It causes rapid changes in the public safety system, and some examples of that is if you have some sort of new training that is needed to prevent terrorism, it's going to affect Director Minnis possibly in the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. It will take time away from law enforcement officers' normal duties to train them up. Could include firefighters and that type of thing. So the phenomenon of Homeland Security, although it brings good training and there are many cross-training issues that can help public safety entities and the administration of justice, I see it as one more layer of requirements on an already stressed system that we need to work very closely with all of the public safety partners and make sure that we're getting the most that we can for the funding. The last thing I'll say on the first question, administration of justice, I think the good news is it does bring more money that does not come out of the state funds. As Homeland Security has evolved, the allotment of those funds for different purposes has broadened. They were very restrictive in the beginning, and now as public safety entities across the nation have engaged Homeland Security, they've realized that a lot of those funds can be used for many, many more things that we need to take a look at across our nation. So I think that we can bring a lot to the table in the administration of justice, but we need to be very careful and we need to very, very closely work with everybody and make sure there's an understanding of how we can support their needs and how they can support our needs, because the federal government is becoming a little bit more mandating with Homeland Security because of all the money that they've given us.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment and then a question. Both the Senator and I and some other members of Oregon had the opportunity to go back to New York after 9/11 and to be a part of some of the initial discussion to put together Oregon's plan for Homeland Security. And then you touched on the law enforcement piece. I think it would be helpful for members of this panel if you would actually, when we get into further discussion of talking about first responders and who all really is involved, because I don't think that others, you know, in addition to law enforcement, you have the mental health communities. It is a far more comprehensive discussion and comprehensive pieces than just, quote, talking law enforcement and those interactions and interrelationships that have been put in place. I think it would be helpful for members of this body, because not only your budget, but talking about human services budget and some of those other pieces and that have to do with when we talk Homeland Security and what that all means.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, Senator Winters. I know the trip that you went back east to New York. I've been on a committee for 2 years writing the behavioral health plan. And I know that, and I will also agree with you, that the definition of first responders of the public safety community has gone outside far beyond what any of us have ever grown up knowing as traditional first responders. And I think it's amazing when you look at all the different disciplines, whether it be public health, mental health, public works, law enforcement, fire, emergency medical, not jokingly, but anymore, anybody can be a first responder. It just kind of depends on where you're at and what you're doing.
I think, and truly, we did clap.
I've heard the stories.
When we visited the site. And it was also the recognition that the response was and had to be and needed to be very comprehensive. I think revisiting what had happened in New York and what had happened in Washington, D.C., to prevent actions in other parts of our country. I think for some of us, I don't think we'll ever forget that visit. And I think it will always impress on us how easy it could be that, you know, whether we're talking to New York City or Salem, Oregon, or what have you. But I just thought it may be valuable information to share with this body the actual breadth and depth of Homeland Security and those that are involved.
And I would just add to that, part of our delegation, a member of our delegation included the faith community, which was a request and a requirement of our participation, as I recall.
Yes,
and
it was.
It would be helpful to hear at a later point how that component is being addressed, included, as we move forward.
Oregon was the only state that included policymakers. Mm-hmm. We were the only state that had legislators.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. I want to do another time check with you. We're about 4 minutes before we close the meeting, and I want to consult with staff, Mr. Wilson. I know you've been out in the audience talking to our partners about how we can extend this conversation into next week. Your proposal is?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will.
Madam
Chair. Boy, I'm sorry.
We'll hold that against
you. One demerit here. Or multiple demerits.
Working on a behavioral health plan.
Yes.
I mean, this building has changed somewhat.
He gets the buy.
I will. What I suggest is that we'll spend the whole time on the Monday meeting on finishing the folks that are scheduled here, if they're able to come. And I think both Mr. Williams and Mr. Jester have said they would do the best they can and to move things around, and then
Thank
we'll
you.
Push Department of Justice back, which we had scheduled for half of the period. Half of the two-hour meeting on Monday, we'll push them back and have them start on Tuesday morning. Or Tuesday afternoon, excuse me.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Just for the good of the order, again, checking in with the members, I hope you're finding this to be time well spent. We will continue next week. Do you have any comments for the good of the order? I want to thank you both for being present, and sorry to cut you off before we do.
Madam Chair, I look forward to talking some more.
I do have one item for the good of the order. It was a question. One of the members wants to know if Mr. Wilson would be willing to give Senator Devlin a wake-up call so that he'll get to committee on time.
Madam Chair, with your indulgence, the good communicator of that, we will try to refrain from our former behavior in the last, but it will not, our reluctance to engage in that may only last a day or two.
What we're trying to establish here is that this will be a committee of hard work and humor. Okay.
Thank you.
And
Madam Chair.
We are adjourned.